You're listening to Leaf Filter Radio, and the guru of gutter protection himself, Chris Counihan, is here to take your most pressing leaf-related questions.
Hey, everybody, Chris here. I understand we have Ron on the line. Ron, where are you calling from?
Uh-oh. Ron, are you calling from a ladder?
Well, I was. I wanted to ask Chris what I need to do to get my gutters ready to have leaf filter installed.
Oh, Ron, you don't have to do anything. A leaf filter trusted pro will come out and clean out your gutters, realign and seal your gutters, and install leaf filter, America's number one gutter protection system.
So I didn't need to get on this ladder?
Ron, leaf filter trusted pros are in your neighborhood and ready to help. Just visit leaffilter.com/day to schedule your free gutter inspection and get up to 30% off.
Thank goodness. What was that site?
That's leaffilter.com/day for your free gutter inspection today. See representative for warranty details. Promotion is 20% off plus a 10% senior or military discount. One discount per household.
Jim Sleeper, writing in Salon, revisits an essay he wrote in 2014 in which he predicted the rise of a demagogue and much of what would follow. Read by me, Ron Butler, for Curio. Possibly nothing annoys readers of journalism more than a columnist or essayist saying, "I told you so." I told you so. On July 14, 2014, a recent spate of American public massacres prompted me to post the following essay here in Salon. It was long before anyone was ready to blame the mayhem on more than terrorism, mental illness, the traffic in guns, or demented white men. I insisted that something worse was in play, something even more dangerous than a particular strain of demagoguery that would mobilize the resentments of white, working-class Americans behind someone more awful than Glenn Beck and Sarah Palin. Immediately after Salon posted this essay, it was reposted by the British website Open Democracy, by Reset in Rome, and by the American sites Alternet and History News Network. Salon's post was noted by the Drudge Report website, which sent thousands of negative comments our way. The essay also provoked responses such as this one by conservative theologian Carl Raschke, who dubbed me an op-ed Jeremiah. It prompted this tweet from Hendrik Hertzberg of The New Yorker. Having thought that I was pretty much alone in wringing my hands over the imminent demise of the American Republic, I was surprised by the volume and vehemence of the reactions. I found Hertzberg's compliment a bit unnerving, since I grew up 6 miles north of the spot where, in 1741, Edwards, the Puritan divine, delivered his own Jeremiad, "Sinners in the Hands of an Angry God." What surprises me now, on rereading the essay, is how presciently, I won't say prophetically, it anticipated the severity of a Republican crisis that many Americans now acknowledge, but that most keep trying to normalize, deflect, or minimize. Let me say right now what the following Jeremiad of 2014 makes obvious. Donald Trump isn't the cause of what's plaguing us. He's only the most prominent among many other carriers and casualties of the disease I diagnose here. In March 2016, as Trump rampaged through the Republican primaries and destroyed the party's establishment, I undertook a second big reckoning here in Salon that prompted a 20-minute interview on WNYC in New York. I've just finished a book that recounts how our civic implosion began 50 years ago, even in upscale American suburbs such as Wellesley, Massachusetts. We'll see who's willing to risk publishing it. As the massacre of synagogue worshipers in Pittsburgh piles atop the massacre of white Baptist church worshipers in Texas, and the massacre of a black church study group in Charleston, atop the massacres in Las Vegas, Sandy Hook, and too many other places around the country, I'll keep right on saying what I did here in 2014. What's killing us is that the Supreme Court, both political parties, most civil liberties advocates, and most journalists continue to indulge the relentless, intrusive, and mindless commercial speech of shareholder-driven corporations, including media companies and social media platforms, that do not deserve First Amendment protection. We need to rethink that protection, from the bottom up, as I have tried to do in The Baffler in summer 2018, in the Los Angeles Review of Books in October 2018, and here in Ceylon when each of those two essays was published. But I began it right here, 4 years ago. I haven't changed a word. You can fill in what's happened since. By the rude bridge that arched the flood, their flag to April's breeze unfurled. Here once the embattled farmers stood and fired the shot heard round the world. Ralph Waldo Emerson, Concord Hymn, 1837. For centuries, most Americans have believed that the shot heard round the world in 1775 from Concord, Massachusetts, heralded the Enlightenment's entry into history. Early observers of America, such as G.W.F. Hegel, Edward Gibbon, and Edmund Burke, believed that too. A new kind of Republican citizen was rising, amid and against adherents of theocracy, divine right monarchy, aristocracy, and mercantilism. Republican citizens were quickening humanity's stride toward horizons radiant with promises never before held and shared as widely as they were in America. The creation of the United States really was a novus ordo seclorum, a new order of the ages, a society's first self-aware, if fumbling and compromised, effort to live by the liberal expectation that autonomous individuals could govern themselves together without having to impose religious doctrines or mystical narratives of tribal blood or soil. With barely a decorous nod to the Creator, the founders of the American Republic conferred on one another the right to have rights, a distinguished group of them constituting the others as we, the people. That revolutionary effort is not just in trouble now, or endangered, or under attack, or reinventing itself. It's in prison, with no prospect of parole. And many Americans, including me, who wring our hands or wave our arms about this, are actually among the jailers. Or we've sleepwalked ourselves and others into the cage and have locked ourselves in. We haven't yet understood the shots fired and heard round the world from 74 American schools, colleges, and military bases since the Sandy Hook School massacre of December 2012. These shots haven't been fired by embattled farmers at invading armies. They haven't been fired by terrorists who've penetrated our surveillance and security systems. With few exceptions, they haven't been fired by aggrieved non-white Americans. They've been fired mostly by young, white American citizens at other white citizens, and by American soldiers at other American soldiers, inside the very institutions where Republican virtues and beliefs are nurtured and defended. They've been fired from within a body politic so drained of candor and trust that beneath our continuing lip service to Republican premises and practices, we've let our court conflate the free speech of flesh and blood citizens with the disembodied wealth of anonymous shareholders. And we've let lawmakers, bought or intimidated by gun peddlers and zealots, render us helpless against torrents of marketed fear and vengeance that are dissolving a distinctively American democratic ethos the literary historian Daniel Aaron characterized as ethical and pragmatic, disciplined and free. Many Americans are adapting to living with variants of force and fraud that erupt in road rage, lethal stampedes by shoppers on sale days, security precautions in their homes against the prospect of armed invasion, gladiatorialization and corruption in sports, nihilism in entertainment that fetishizes violence without context and sex without attachment, the casino-like financing of utterly unproductive economic activities such as the entertainment I've just mentioned, and the predatory lending that has tricked millions out of their homes, the commercial groping and goosing of private lives and public spaces, even in the marketing of ordinary consumer goods, and the huge new prison industry that Americans have created to deter or punish broken, violent men, most of them non-white, only to find schools in even the whitest, safest neighborhoods imprisoned by fear of white gunmen who've often been students themselves. Abroad, meanwhile, thousands more shots, fiendish and celebratory, are being fired into the corpses of American national security and nation-building projects by terrorists and fanatics we were told had been decimated. These projects cost trillions of dollars and hundreds of thousands of lives, limbs, homes, and hopes, including those of American soldiers, contractors, and idealists. Their sacrifices can't justify retroactively what shouldn't have been undertaken in the first place. Stressed by all this Republican derangement, millions are spending billions on palliatives, medications, addictions, and even surveillance designed to protect them from themselves. All those vials, syringes, security systems, and shootings reflect the insinuation of what Gibbon called a slow and secret poison into the vitals of the empire, until Roman citizens no longer possessed that public courage which is nourished by the love of independence, the sense of national honor, the presence of danger, and the habit of command. They received laws and governors from the will of their sovereign and trusted for their defense to a mercenary army. Only a few late Roman republicans, recalling their old freedoms, concluded, with Livy, that we have become too ill to bear our sickness or their cures. You might argue, and quite rightly, that we the people have always subverted the truths we'd held to be self-evident, beginning with slavery and continuing with plutocracy. Yet somehow the Republic kept experiencing what Lincoln called a new birth of freedom, thanks only partly to the fortuitous confluence of two oceans' protection, a vast continent's ever-alluring frontier, and unending streams of aspiring immigrants. Not like the brazen giant of Greek fame, with conquering limbs astride from land to land, here at our sea-washed sunset gates will stand a mighty woman with a torch, whose flame is the imprisoned lightning, and her name, Mother of Exiles. True enough, the Republic thus limned by Emma Lazarus in The New Colossus, her poem for the Statue of Liberty, needed those exiles for its labor market, and it still had a guiding aristocracy of sorts, but supposedly only an aristocracy of talent and virtue, as Jefferson put it, and not one of blood and ill-gotten wealth. True, too, certain lingering Puritan beliefs had nourished in the embattled farmers, and even long before 1775 in some of the Puritans themselves, a conviction that resistance to tyranny is obedience to God. That injunction, to defy worldly power sometimes in the name of a higher power, legitimated individual conscience and autonomy right up through the nonviolent defiance of the best of the civil rights and anti-war movements of the 1960s. But the American emphasis on individual conscience and autonomy also gestated a liberal capitalist republic that has reduced individualism to market exchanges in ways that are now destroying both individuals and the society. A liberal capitalist republic has to rely on its citizens to uphold voluntarily certain public virtues and beliefs that neither the liberal state nor markets can nourish or defend. The liberal state isn't supposed to judge between one way of life and another, after all, and markets reward you as a self-interested consumer and investor, not as a citizen who might put such interests aside at times to advance a greater good that self-interest alone can't achieve. The moral silence and often bankruptcy of states and markets leaves citizen leaders to be nourished and trained all the more intensively in institutions that stand somewhat apart from the state and markets. The Puritan founders of America's oldest colleges understood this, but they expected that those colleges' graduates would serve a theocratic state that would control markets and everything else. We're right to dismiss the Puritans' theocracy because it was repressive and hypocritical. But we're wrong to have lost a side of its animating spirit that would have kept markets from controlling and devouring Republican government and even our bodies and ourselves. Having miscarried Republican self-discipline and conviction so badly, we find ourselves scrambling to monitor, measure, and control the consequences, such as the proliferation of mental illness and the glorification and marketing of guns, as if these were causing our implosion. They aren't. They're symptoms, not causes. Reactions to widespread heartbreak at the breakdown of what Tocqueville called Republican habits of the heart that we used to cultivate. Equally symptomatic, not causal, are self-avowedly deviant and transgressive gyrations by people who imagine that the sunset of civic Republican order heralds a liberating Dionysian dawn. Sloughing off our bad old repressions, we've been swept up by the swift market currents that turn countercultures into over-the-counter cultures and promote a free-for-all that's a free-for-none as citizens become customers chasing freedoms for sale. Even our war makers and mongers' grand strategies and the growing militarization of our domestic police forces are more symptomatic than causal of the public derangement that's rising all around us. But turning the bearers of such frightening symptoms into our primary villains or scapegoats would only deepen our blindness to the disease, which is as old as the biblical worship of the golden calf and as new as Goldman Sachs. It runs deeper than anything that anyone but the Puritans and their Old Testament models tried to tackle. I'm not suggesting we can or should return to Puritanism. Anyone expecting to recover that faith and way of life is stumbling up dry stream beds toward wellsprings that have themselves run dry. But we do need wellsprings that could fortify us to take risks even more daunting than those taken by the embattled farmers. We'd somehow have to reconfigure or abandon empty comforts, escapes, and protections that both free market conservatives and readers of Salon are accustomed to buying and selling, sometimes against our own best hopes and convictions. Our cure would also require reweaving a fabric of public candor and comedy strong enough to resist the rise of ressentiment, a public psychopathology once associated with the rise of fascism, in which insecurities, envy, and hatreds that many have been nursing in private converge in scary public eruptions that diminish their participants, even in seeming to make them big. Ressentiment's little big man seeks easy targets for frustrations born of exploitation by powers that he's afraid to face and reckon with head-on. Blaming scapegoats warps his assessment of his hardships and options and drives him to wreak vengeance on them as soon as there are enough little big men, and women, of course, to do so en masse under a Glenn Beck or a Sarah Palin. Whether ressentiment erupts in racist violence, sectarian fanaticism, anti-communist witch hunts, totalitarian show trials, politically correct cultural revolutions, or sadistic escapism, its most telling symptoms are paranoia and routinized bursts of hysteria. Under the ministrations of gifted demagogues, its grievances and pain assume a fleeting brilliance that soon collapses, tragically or catastrophically, on its own cowardice and lies. Its targets often shift. The 9/11 attacks brought a reprieve of sorts to African Americans, the Republic's most enduring scapegoats, when the burden of white censure pivoted toward Muslims. Louis Farrakhan's Nation of Islam lost credibility, but so did whites such as the neoconservative Daniel Pipes, who kept on insisting years after 9/11 that the first black president was a Muslim and a friend of terrorists. The slipperiness of scapegoating became clear to me in 1993, as I wrote about a deranged black gunman, Colin Ferguson, who'd opened fire in a Long Island Railroad car, killing six passengers. Even while holding him responsible, I saw him bearing symptoms far more widespread than his private demons. Noting Ferguson's enthusiasm for a politics of rage, paranoia, and death threats, then prominent on a black radio station and in demagogic street politics, I warned that even deranged loners are sometimes better attuned to our subconscious hatreds and fears than we care to admit. That was true, too, of Jared Loughner, the white, paranoid schizophrenic and anti-government fantasist who killed a U.S. District Court judge and six other people while trying to kill, but severely wounding, U.S. Representative Gabrielle Giffords and 13 others in 2011. While apocalyptic religious and racist ranting can provoke emotionally disturbed people, so can journalism and entertainment that massage hatreds too diffuse to be called racist, religious, or ideological. Some school shooters nursed the depictions of violence and lust that are pumped incessantly into young Americans' horizons with the help of new technologies and investment strategies that ride reckless misreadings of the First Amendment. This hasn't been done with malevolent intent as often as it's been done in a kind of civic mindlessness by media corporations, incentivized and indeed forced by market pressures to bypass our brains and hearts on the way to our lower viscera and wallets, by exaggerating fears of armed home invasion, government takeover, and vengeful victory by gunplay. Even though relatively few young Americans follow these siren songs into acts of destruction, the public fetishizing of sex and violence without context or caring dampens many others' faith in society during their formative years. You don't need to know a lot of developmental psychology or anthropology to know that children crave culturally coherent tests of prowess and loyalty in symbolic rites of passage that ratify their communal belonging. When such rites and symbols fail, some flail about, seeking order in private delusions, Dartmouth College fraternities, and public orchestrations of ressentiment. In 1775, most American communities still filtered such basic generational and human needs through traditions that encompassed kinship bonds and seasonal rhythms. In Common Sense, Thomas Paine could urge readers to take their recent experiences of monarchy to the touchstones of nature and decide whether they would abide the empire's abuses. Today, those touchstones of nature, and with them, Republican convictions about selfhood and society, have been torn up by runaway engines and developments in technology, communications, and even intimate biology that would terrify Paine, Adam Smith, and John Locke, not to mention those who fired the first shot at Concord. This time, we're all in bed with the enemy. In The Cultural Contradictions of Capitalism, 40 years ago, Daniel Bell, no anti-capitalist but prophetic enough about the worship of golden calves, argued that free markets no longer make free men because economic liberalism has become corporate oligopoly and in the pursuit of private wants, a hedonism that is destructive of social needs. He warned that consumer capitalism displaces the needs that the early republic filtered through nature's rhythms and kinship traditions. It displaces those needs with ginned-up wants that, by their nature, are unlimited and insatiable. The rational calculation of efficiency and return displace the principle of the public household, strip mining and selling off fragments of cultural narratives. Without civic wellsprings and narratives deep and compelling enough to strengthen a society's adhesives and disciplines in the hearts of its young, neither free market conservatives nor world is flat neoliberal cosmopolitans can reconcile their professed commitments to ordered republican liberty with their knee-jerk obedience to riptides of destructive investment that are dissolving republican virtue and sovereignty before our eyes. No wonder we're losing our vision, in both senses of the word. Our foreign policy savants across the ideological spectrum were too blind to see that the Soviet Union was so much weaker than American Cold War propaganda and hysteria insisted, that it imploded in 1989. The fabled missile gap that John F. Kennedy ran on in 1960 was as imaginary as Saddam Hussein's weapons of mass destruction. But anyone who tried telling either of those truths was charged with a failure of nerve, or worse, by the blind warmongers in our midst. Our business press was too blind to see that a tsunami of predatory lending would wreck the national economy and throw millions from their homes. Our market-addled congressional committees and blue-ribbon commissions on national intelligence couldn't discover, until Edward Snowden revealed it, that public surveillance had taken an all-devouring life of its own. neoconservative and Vulcan conservative advocates of using American military force to spread democracy abroad couldn't see that their strategy was doomed because democracy isn't woven that way, and because it was destroying democracy at home in ways that, if unchecked, will destroy the republic whose strengths they've so badly misconstrued and betrayed. Our consumer society, addicted to cheap comforts and quick fixes, can't see its own Orwellian ensnarement by commercial censors, and it couldn't take Al Gore's inconvenient truth about global warming seriously enough to offset the onrushing damage with the serious sacrifices we have yet to make. Our gilded political consultants, pollsters, and campaign donors were too blind to see the boiling undercurrents that have swept away House Majority Leader Eric Cantor. Nor can they see that Cantor's political demise presages an inflammation of ressentiment so wild that the coming specious "Who Lost Iraq?" debate will be accompanied by the shot that some military veteran who feels betrayed will fire at a politician who's been left holding the empty bag of our civic Republican hopes. So we are flying almost totally blind, punched bloody by a hand that we keep insisting is invisible. We can see only the sickness of the gunmen and of the proliferation of their guns. Treatment of those symptoms is urgently needed, but it will be insufficient to curb the wrecking ball that global capitalism has become on our willfully blind watch, and triage won't renew the civic fabric. Whenever Republican candor and courage have seemed about to succumb like this to tribal and theocratic delusions or to force and fraud in the past, some citizens have roused others to fend off threats to Republican premises and practices. In 1776, a young schoolteacher named Nathan Hale was caught trying to track and expose the military and intelligence operations of the only established, legitimate government of his time. But just before his hanging, he said, "I only regret that I have but one life to give for my country," and became an incarnation of a nascent republic. Hale's dignity in adversity, unfathomable to many of us these days, anticipated that of Martin Luther King Jr. and the black churchgoers who walked unarmed and trembling toward armed men and dogs, with nothing but their faith and their long-shot strategy to delegitimate the seemingly impregnable segregationist establishment of their time by appealing to Republican principles and an American civil religion whose theology was as vague as that of the founders. Hale's dignity also anticipated that of three Yale seniors I came upon one wintry morning in 1968, as they gave University Chaplain William Sloan Coffin Jr. their military draft cards to announce their resistance to the U.S. government on behalf of the American Republic. "The government says we're criminals, but we say the government is criminal for waging this war," said one of the seniors, struggling to find his voice. For all we knew, these guys were about to be arrested on the spot, and some of us felt arrested morally by their example, because they were ready to pay the penalty of law in order to affirm their commitment to honest law itself. Coffin, who held to a Calvinist theology that, like King's, saw resistance to tyranny as obedience to God, was present to bless a courage that few national security state conservatives understand. In the idiom of an American civil religion, few neoliberals and postmodern leftists understand. When he quoted Dylan Thomas, "Do not go gentle into that good night. Rage, rage against the dying of the light." That civil religion seemed to awaken briefly and to walk and talk again, remoralizing the state and the law, and the silent, wild confusion I was feeling gave way to something like awe. I described this experience in the Washington Monthly in 2000, during the protracted election of George W. Bush. Hale's courage also anticipated Edward Snowden's. Both young men may have been impetuous and otherwise flawed in some respects, but they showed that resistance to corrupted power requires not only prowess, means, and will, but an elusive Republican sensibility that's cultivated in civil society and confirmed in little daily interactions long before it emerges in demonstrations of civic courage that startle and move other citizens. With a wonderment somewhat like Hegel's, the German political philosopher Jürgen Habermas marveled at this constitutional patriotism in American citizens who possessed what Gibbon described as that public courage which is nourished by the love of independence, the sense of national honor, the presence of danger, and the habit of command. When I tell young millennials these stories, though, many of them listen pretty much as they would to tales about knights in shining armor, long ago and far away. Much closer to them are the school shootings and internet mayhem that make brave citizenship seem archaic, implausible, and irrelevant to self-discovery and social change. Yet, Republican expectations do have ways of resurfacing whenever we, the people, begin to imagine what our lives would be like, singly and together, if we had to live without them. Not everyone can be seduced or intimidated away from them. Still, so many Americans are generations removed from an easily recoverable religious or ethno-racial identity or other adhesive that we have to ask, where are the touchstones or narratives strong enough to renew public virtues and beliefs that neither markets nor the liberal state do much to nourish or defend? The question should prompt a quest for a political culture that isn't too commercial and vapid, and that isn't held together only by demagoguery and delusion. No reconfiguration of today's capitalism will be possible without something better than that. Yet no think tank, legislature, or foundation can carry that quest or that reconfiguration to a just conclusion. Nor can an Occupy Wall Street that isn't grounded in something deeper than its own noble effort to be the change it wants us all to make. Nor can our illness be cured by champions of a new foreign policy realism, such as Robert Kagan, who urge us to face the inevitable challenges of a world where only willpower and force can sustain the liberal order that many Americans take for granted. That's right as far as it goes, but it begs the question of where willpower comes from and what, within the liberal order itself, is sapping that willpower. Quoting Michael Ignatieff, Kagan speculates candidly that liberal civilization itself runs deeply against the human grain and is achieved and sustained only by the most unremitting struggle against human nature. Perhaps, Kagan adds, this fragile democratic garden requires the protection of a liberal world order, with constant feeding, watering, weeding, and the fencing off of an ever-encroaching jungle. But he can't seem to face the challenge posed by the new shots heard round the world from America. The jungle and its encroachments begin not only abroad, but within our own garden. What seems our greatest weakness could be one of our greatest strengths, although it too won't be enough. Even 150 years after the founding, the philosopher George Santayana wrote that Americans still heralded the Enlightenment's entry into history precisely because they'd all been uprooted from their several soils and ancestries and plunged together into one vortex, whirling irresistible in a space otherwise quite empty. To be an American is of itself almost a moral condition, an education, and a career. Although there's plenty to regret and respect in the traditions we've lost, there's no turning back from the moral condition and career we face as citizens. We have no choice but to keep faith with the Republic and one another. If Americans have a manifest destiny now, it's to lead in weaving a new Republican fabric that markets can serve but not subvert. In 2008, Barack Obama seemed to incarnate so brilliantly the promise of weaving our diversity into a new Republican discipline. He even invoked Puritan and biblical wellsprings in some of his speeches, that many people round the world considered him a prophet who would satisfy their hunger for new narratives. Probably no national political leader ever can do that. The narratives the world needs now will have to come from other prophets and leaders yet unsung. I do think that Americans will be strong among them, if only because we've had so much experience generating that hunger by generating the civic Republican capitalist effort that has failed. That was, "Our Republic is in crisis, and it's killing us. Can we really claim we didn't see it coming?" by Jim Sleeper, writing in Salon on October 30th, 2018. Read by Ron Butler for Curio.